In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
We do this every year.
Maud Aviernik.
There are many ways we remember them.
Geneviève Bergeron.
A victim's niece reading out 14 names to the silent night sky. 14 beams of light shining over the mountain for the city and the world to see.
14 white roses, one for each of the victims.
What happened in Montreal that day was a senseless act of violence, shocked the country and the world.
Today will mark the 30th time we've paused to mourn of 14 women killed and 14 people wounded in the misogynist terror attack at L'École Polytechnique in Montreal. I hope you paid attention to how I said that. As we mourn the victims every year, we also have a conversation. And I can check the boxes off for you. Is violence against women a problem in Canada? Yes. Should more be done? Yes. What should be done? Many things. Which things will get done? Probably the easy ones. What about the big things? Well, we'll talk about them. This isn't to say that there's anything wrong with acknowledging the problem and the scope of it, but it does get repetitive. And while today might mark the 30th anniversary of what is often called the Montreal Massacre, it's worth noting that we've got about 28 and a half years to go before we mark the 30th anniversary of the most recent misogynist terror attack. So while lots of things have changed over the past 3 decades, the most important thing hasn't. And any conversation today needs to start right there. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Sarah Bosfeld is a reporter who has covered this issue for quite some time in rural Ontario, in the courts in Toronto. She's also hosted this podcast and talked about it here. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, Jordan. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we wanted to get your perspective as somebody who has covered this through a number of lenses. So I guess my first question is kind of personal. What's it like becoming a go-to voice on a topic like this?
Well, I guess as a reporter, you know, I was general assignment reporter and then worked at Chatelaine for 4 years and really got entrenched in this issue. That was really a time when, you know, violence against women became a major conversation. And it's really hard, you know, as a reporter, you want kind of separate yourself from the story, but mm-hmm. I found myself unable to do that. You know, I'm a woman in this country. I found myself just in so angry and feeling helpless about the fact that so many women and girls and children and family members are affected by violence against women, you know, and I think covering, like, hearing people's stories and having them trust you with their stories about, like, this completely changing them on a cellular level in their bodies, in their lives, it's a weight to carry, but it's nothing compared to having to actually deal with it as a victim, as a survivor, rather, which is sort of the terminology that most people like to use. But it's a responsibility. I really feel like, you know, if we're going to be on the side of the right side of history and you know, doing journalism and talk about these issues to make the world a better place, like, you got to keep moving forward and you can't stop talking about these things. You know, we tend to just want to talk about it on days like this, but
right.
I mean, we have been in recent years, which I find heartening.
Well, that was almost my next question is what are you thinking during, you know, for some reason we mark round number anniversaries for good things and horrific things. Mm-hmm. And this week has been leading up to today, the 30th anniversary of the L'École Polytechnique attack. What are you thinking of the conversation around it as today approached? Because it's been a conversation all week.
Yeah, it's been a conversation all week, and 30 years is an entire full generation. It's three decades of time passing, and I'm thinking a lot about how we've had attacks like this, mass killings like this, happen in recent memory, very recent memory. Mm-hmm. Just a few years ago in Toronto, you know, there was a mass attack where the alleged perpetrator, who's now going to be facing trial next year probably, was targeting women. Yeah. You know, we've had over social media a lot of ways for people to openly talk about their hatred of women. And it's happening, you know, at the same time as we are, as a mainstream society, I think doing a much better job of trying to raise awareness about this issue. Mainstream media is so much more attuned to this issue. Politicians are, certainly here in Canada. We've heard a lot about it over the past 4 years. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking a lot about what is effective, you know, what is actually going to turn the tide. And I think societal change moves very slowly, and 30 years seems like a really long time. And there has been progress, but time marches slowly.
We talk about it a lot more than we did 30 years ago, maybe. But do we understand gender-based violence better now than we did in 1989 or even 10 years ago?
I think we do in most cases. You know, I've been reading some great pieces about this attack at Polytechnic 30 years ago, pieces by McLean Zan Kingston, Liz Renzetti at the Globe and Mail, and they point out that at the time, the media was very, very, very hesitant, and government officials and the public was very hesitant to actually say this is misogyny. This was motivated by, you know, a hatred of women, and have that be the crime attached to mm-hmm. the crime of murder. You know, even though he wrote in a letter, right. you know, explicitly said, I hate feminists and this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. But still there was a resistance to that idea. And even in what was it 2018, 2017, I think.
The Toronto van attack.
It was 2018. I still noticed some resistance in the media and amongst the public to say this was an act of real hatred against people who happen to be women, you know. And I think some of that had to do with, you know, the way that information filters out. But mm-hmm. he, you know, and we have to be careful in the media. And I think, you know, the way that the justice system is set up, you know, innocent until proven guilty, right? And motivations have to be investigated before we can say beyond a reasonable doubt that this person carried out this attack and why. But at the same time, I think in the gaps, there comes to be a bit of, not permissiveness, I don't know if that's a word that I'm looking for, but a way for us to sort of evade the actual facts of how and why these things happen and face the real issue at hand, the real motivation for this continued violence.
And is that what happens when we call it what it is? How does it change the conversation when it goes from, we don't know why this person did this, to, as you said, labeling it, this person did it because he hated women?
Yeah, I mean, Anne Kingston's piece in McLean's did a good job of this. She argued, you know, and her sources certainly argued that we need to we talk about this in a passive voice, right? We talk about violence against women and mm-hmm. as if it's just some this amorphous being or nothing causes these women to die.
Right. Like when we say someone was hit by a car.
Yeah, and I think about, like, I was a general assignment reporter, like I said to you, and I've written countless, you know, we call them, you know, jests or briefs, depending on, you
right.
know, which
yeah.
newspaper you worked at the time. Always framing it as, like, this happened to this person, but making sure that we keep away from who did it, mm-hmm. you know? And even, you know, just like a man did it or a woman did it. But, like, again, if we want to keep us, like, arm's length against, you know, the scales of justice, you can't even do that, you know?
Right.
That's maybe making this person guilty when they're not. So you have to be careful. It's so messy. But I think, like, talking about it as a broader issue of men's violence against women, I think that's what Anne was arguing should happen. And I think maybe that would be the leap that we need to make to actually stop talking about this in the passive voice, start talking about, like, who the perpetrator is a little bit more. But I think, you know, there's risks to that, right? Like, we already feel like we're in a very polarized society. Like, would that make it worse? You
mm-hmm.
know, would that have men say, well, it's not me, you know
hashtag
what I'm seeing.
Not all men. We've seen that
movement. That was after, like, the Elliot Rodger killings. Is that 2014?
Yep.
which was in California, and he has now been seen as a hero amongst this, you know, cohort of people online now known as incels, which the van attacker identified, alleged van attacker identified as being. He felt, you know, hard done by because he wasn't meeting all of these standards of beauty or standards of manliness. He felt like women were at fault for his lot in life. I mean, we, you know, if we can identify that men are attached to that, that even unfair standards on men too, and these expectations we put on men are around that, you know, maybe we could move a little further in the direction of some action and prevention happening.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
How are we doing? Do we have any idea? And I know, like you said, this whole thing is so messy, which is what makes it really hard to ascribe clear lines of progress or numbers to. But do we have any general sense of how far we've come since 1989 or what the pace of gender-based violence is in Canada?
Well, I think it's like a really logical and important question to ask. But I challenge you to reframe it a little bit to say, because I think when we talk about, oh, it's better now. Oh, it's better now. You know, like there's less homicide now. Everything's going well. No. Every 6 days in Canada, a woman is killed by her intimate partner. Of homicides in Canada, you know, men, yes, they're killed at a greater rate, perhaps, but they are killed by someone they know, an associate, like someone that, you know, that they're in an altercation with often.
Mm-hmm.
70% of women and children who die in this country are killed by somebody, a man they've loved and trusted, who's supposed to be there to take care of them. There's something really wrong with that picture. 70%?
Mm-hmm.
That is a messed up proportion, you know? And I think, like, we
is
have to decide
really
if we're
grappling?
Satisfied with that. Well, I mean, there's certainly an effort amongst academics. There's a great academic effort, Canadian Femicide Observatory for Justice and Accountability, that's run out of the University of Guelph. They're actually keeping track of how many women, children, family members are killed because there was misogyny at the root of this violence. And that is a disproportionate number of Indigenous women, you know, a problem we've been talking about for so many years in this country. You know, it's people, you know, and they're actually attaching names to the survivors who often go unnamed as well, too. And trying to keep track of what happens in those cases, I think last year was, you know, especially bad with this problem, you know. But I mean, was it? They were actually counting the numbers last year, you know.
Yeah,
that's a huge gap in the system in Canada right now. There's such a patchwork of information. It's all sort of provincially mandated. There's different definitions of these crimes, no matter, you know, depending on where you go, and the responses are different. There's no standard level of service or even a federal charge for this kind of, I mean, there's a federal charge of murder, but there isn't a federal charge attached to this kind of idea of misogyny being behind a lot of these. There's, you know, charges about terrorism, you know, and that's actually been a new part of the conversation about violence against women. You know, should we actually look at incel attacks, you know, people that are motivated by misogyny as terrorists, and even just look at take a wider scope and be like, is this terrorism? You know, and I think that's a mental leap for a lot of people, but it's an interesting idea.
Well, the term incel is something that I wanted to ask you about, because on the one hand, I guess it's good to have a term to which to refer to a specific kind of attacker in the same way that we'd refer to someone as a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, is it helpful to identify these attackers as part of a group? You know, the alleged van attacker posted that it was the incel rebellion, which
they identify as part of a group, don't they?
Yeah. And is it helpful to the conversation to that this terminology has now been applied to lonely men online, even if in every case it does not lead to murder or even real world violence?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question because, I mean, we already feel so polarized. Are we going to further push these guys into a corner, you know? But I mean, that's why at the same time as trying to crack down on sort of and show how serious this is as a motivator of violence, but also tied to larger societal problems, you know, a larger social norms of just seeing women as less than men, treating them as if their place is in this one area and not others, you know, in the home, for example. And it's all interconnected with inequality in so many ways. It's intertwined with inequality of not just between genders, you know, and it's not just two genders, you know, there's fluidity as we've come to understand now. And, you know, but we don't do a good enough job about talking about the intersections of that, of course, you know, Indigenous women, women of color, migrant women, women with disabilities, you know. And I think like part of why people are so hesitant to actually talk in real ways about violence against women is that they want it to be this kind of like, well, all lives matter sort of thing.
Right.
I don't know if I'm getting away from your question, but if we say that we care about violence against women, then we deal with it in like a binary way of like, well, then we must not care about violence against men or anything happening with men, or we must hate men. It's the core problem of feminism, right? Like people think about everything in these.
Well, that's what gives birth to men's rights activists, right?
Exactly.
Is the idea
that if you're doing
work on feminism or on helping women in general fight for equality, that you're naturally rejecting men.
No, exactly. It's just this problematic way of thinking about the world. Like we're not very good at unpacking real complexities of things and thinking about things with so much more nuance. You know, we know the world is full of gray, but we want to talk in black and white and we can't seem to get out of that. You know, and I think part of the issue is that, you know, we take it all on so individually. You know, and also something like a term like domestic violence. Anne makes this point in her piece, too. It's like that inherently is a private matter thing. Right. And so we don't want to get in people's business either, you know, but I'm afraid of the incel groups, you know, these men who self-identify as lonely and online. Maybe they would get more power if we as a society legitimize them as much more of a motivated, organized group, you know. I'm not well steeped in terrorism.
Right, but it's the difference between a lone wolf and ISIS.
Well, exactly.
Right?
But like, but does ISIS gain a little bit of power and legitimacy when we talk about them as ISIS? You know, that's a whole other road to go down. But it's an interesting question of like, are we fueling this polarization? But we can't, I think, worry only about that. We actually have to like on the ground create these solutions for these communities, because those are families that are affected by violence against women. It's not just women and children who we purport to talk about as, you know, the valued members of society. Men must protect the women and children, you know, but God forbid they actually need to have any of their own rights protected. I mean, and family violence too, like it's not just an intimate partner and the kids. It can often be, you know, outside of that too. It's mother, grandmothers and cousins and aunts and uncles. Like we tend to just think about it as this private thing between two people and maybe their kids. It's just not.
I did want to bring you back to sort of your descriptions from the ground, because you've, like I mentioned off the top, you've covered femicide in rural areas. You covered the Gomeshi trial. You've covered this issue in many aspects during your career. Have you seen a change over the last little while in terms of how police respond to it or how the courts deal with it? And are attitudes changing in like the power structures that actually confront it?
Yeah, I think there has been really important work in the past 4 years or so, 4 or 5 years, socially as well. You know, I think when Gian Gomeshi was charged with sexual assault and the related charges, that in Canada, I think, shook us up a little. I think it really had us pay attention to unpacking the idea of consent and highlighting that the law actually has very clear, you know, of definitions of that, that somehow judges maybe, you know, it's left up to their interpretation, or it's up to so much interpretation by the public as well. And, you know, and the gaps that therein, you know, Robin Doolittle at the Globe and Mail did such important work on police response, which is that there's a whole classification in charges or how they make their decisions around charges, and it's like unfounded, you know, which really essentially means that the officer didn't believe this complainant. And I mean, that then it of course doesn't go anywhere, you know, and I think, and also on the stand of the Gomeshi trial too, like we saw how complainants were treated. And I think, you know, we can applaud people who did their jobs, quote unquote, or didn't do them well enough within the system. And again, treated as this like black and white, you know, adversary, you know, versus adversary thing. Women are the ones who fall through the cracks there. They don't come forward because they see somebody so publicly torn apart on the stand. You know, they don't come forward because they learn that, oh, my case is just going to be unfounded. So I think it's a double-pronged thing, right? Like, I believe that we made progress by having those conversations and those, you know, and obviously there were actual, like, changes thanks to Doolittle's contribution there. And I mean, there have been really important discussions within the legal community in terms of reforming, you know, who's on the bench and how they're trained and so on. But it gets stalled as well. So I think, like, you can have progress and then you can have steps backwards, you know? So I'm trying to say very clumsily that I think the conversation has made us better informed on these issues, but I don't know that that necessarily means that it's deterring people from carrying out this violence. I don't know that it necessarily means that people are more likely to come forward because they know more about how it works, you know? And I mean, having the federal government paying attention to gender-based violence and these issues is crucial. It's critical. But then last year, you know, a special rapporteur from the United Nations comes to Canada and, you know, maybe the government was hoping for some, you know, sunshine and rainbows, like, you're doing great. And I think there was some of that, but there was also just like, you need a federal law around this kind of violence in order to actually prevent it and to respond appropriately to it. You know, we need a national action plan, which is different from a strategy, which they rolled out in 2017. I mean, I really support the fact that the government is giving money to women's organizations on the ground, because that was taken away from them with the previous leadership of this country. But at the same time, it's like, is it enough money? Are you actually giving enough infrastructure so that this money goes further and longer and makes sure that these women who are fighting so hard to make a change don't feel burnt out? Because you asked me from Go how it feels to be a go-to on this, and I don't even consider myself a go-to, but I am somebody who pays attention to these issues. I'm tired. Yeah. And I'm not even somebody who directly talks with, you know, survivors of this violence all the time, you know, as my life's work. This is something I do occasionally, and I pay attention to it. But I'm also not a survivor directly of this violence. Think about how it feels to have this stuff coming at you all the time. You know, but it's not, but your life isn't necessarily better at the end of the day.
Right. Well, one of the things that I did want to get out of this discussion today, because I knew it was going to be messy, because it's a messy issue, is what kind of direct things men like myself who are in the media, who find themselves every year on December 6th having a conversation about this topic, what kinds of direct actions can we take that would help the conversation be less messy and provide more forward momentum?
Well, I would like men in the media as well to care about violence against women issues. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at bylines on those stories. By and large, they're by women. Robin Doolittle is a woman. I was a woman in that courtroom. I wasn't the only woman in that courtroom.
Ann Kingston, Liz Ranzetti, you've mentioned
them
today.
Absolutely. Where are the men saying, this is so unconscionable that we have so many women and children dying by the hands of a man that they knew and loved and trusted, you know? There's something seriously wrong with that. And I mean also beyond just general news coverage. I want men to sort of
grapple with the fact that,
think about it, wrestle with it.
It's hard to think about, can I tell you?
It's hard, especially because it's not your direct personal experience. Until somebody in your life is killed by a man because misogyny is at the root of that. Mm-hmm. You know? And that's not your fault, Jordan. That's not anyone's fault who's a male reporter, per se, or an editor. It's a structure that we live in. It's the way that we've been taught to report on these issues as well. Me as a female, as a journalist in general, general assignment news reporter, I was taught to be like, woman killed, you know, not woman killed by man with, you know, this weapon, you know, and police believe this to be a motivator, you know? It's the structures, it's the water we're swimming in, but I'm hoping that the temperature of that water is changing a bit, that we're actually having more people in the pool with us to care about these issues and to just really steep themselves in how nobody is served by this nobody dealing with this problem appropriately. We're all actually suffering for not paying attention to this issue. And so I want you to grapple with it. I want you to look for stories, investigations, ways that we can improve the system, going after politicians, legislators, to say, look, like, these issues are not just women's issues that only women should pay attention to. Our society is going to be so much better if we all look at an anniversary day like today and say, that's super messed up and it's ongoing. I'm going to look at the numbers. I'm going to look at the holes that we have in the system. And I'm going to try to do some good work with the skill set that I have. And I really believe in journalism and changing that. And I really believe in the way that we talk to each other and relate to each other in real life can change that. But we got to step out of these silos as that's a women's issue. That's something that we just deal with this one day of the year. Like, there's real stories and real issues that need to be unpacked on this file. And join me. You know, people with great investigative skills, get out there and do this work.
We will talk about this again before December 6th of next year. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Sarah Bosfeld is a writer, a reporter, and an occasional host of this podcast. This podcast is The Big Story, and you can find more of them, including several hosted by Sarah, at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can talk to us always on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN, and you can give us a rating, leave us a review on any podcast application that lets you do those things, and you can find us on any of them, whether they do or not. Claire Brassard is the lead producer of The Big Story. Ryan Clark and Stephanie Phillips are our associate producers, and Elisa Nielsen is our digital editor. And I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk on Monday.
Hi there. I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.